Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, where cool pavement can and cannot be effective.
And why Democrats like Governor Katie Hobbs and Attorney General Chris Mays are taking very different approaches to the incoming Trump administration.
But first, here is a stat that might surprise you after the commanding lead Donald Trump took in the election. According to exit polls, while he saw major gains among Latino voters, Black voters, even young voters, here in Arizona, at least, he got less of the Mormon vote than he did 4 years earlier. Voters who are members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints have traditionally been a Republican stronghold here and across the country. But they have also been skeptical of Trump, often on moral grounds. From Mitt Romney and Jeff Flake to John Giles, who's on his way out of the Mesa mayor's office, LDS leaders have often been the loudest opposition to the now president-elect. And LDS voters have been reticent to turn out for him. In 2016, Trump's share in Utah's election was just 45%. This year, it was 59%. I spoke more about it with Samuel Benson, national political correspondent for the Deseret News in Utah, which is owned by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
We always talk about that 2016 race in which Donald Trump really struggled to win over Latter-day Saint voters. And it's worth remembering that for decades, Latter-day Saints have been a staunchly Republican and conservative voting bloc. I mean, it's been, 60 years since 1964 that a Democrat won the state of Utah. That was Lyndon B. Johnson. So you have decades upon decades of Latter-day Saint voters in Utah and across the Mountain West supporting Republicans. But then when Trump enters in 2016, that dam begins to break.
Yeah.
And it's largely over issues of character and morality. They're upset about his stance on immigration and what he's saying about Muslim refugees and migrants in particular. They're upset with some of his personal scandals and his extramarital affairs. And so he finishes below 50% in Utah in 2016. And then we see a big jump when he runs in 2020 and then similar levels in 2024. And a lot of people are saying, what happened was there this shift or this acquiescence to Trump? And that might be part of it. I think another big part of it is just the reality that there was a third party candidate on the ballot in Utah in 2016 who was very popular in Evan McMullen,
right,
who won about 20% of the vote. And there wasn't a strong third party candidate in 2020 or 2024.
Right. Okay. So we saw a bigger percentage of the vote go to Trump, but the third party candidate wasn't on the ballot this time around.
Correct.
Do you know at this point, Sam, like how the LDS vote has shaken out?
So it's really hard to know because Latter-day Saints are such a small percentage of the population nationally. We're only about 2% of the national electorate. And so any exit poll you have either isn't going to include a Latter-day Saint sample, or they're not going to go into much detail on them or lump them with other Christian voters.
Mm-hmm.
The only exception I found this early, and again, we're only about 2 weeks out from the election, and so better exit polls will come out as we get farther and farther away from Election Day. But so far, Fox News, in conjunction with the Associated Press, did an exit poll where they included Latter-day Saint voters or Mormon voters. And I'm particularly interested by how Harris and Trump performed in Arizona. That, of course, was one of the two states that both candidates really targeted Latter-day Saint voters, Arizona and Nevada being the two battlegrounds. In 2020, so in that Biden-Trump year, Donald Trump won 80% of the Mormon vote in Arizona.
Right.
And Joe Biden finished with 18%. But in 2024, so this past election cycle, Harris got 24% of the vote and Trump only got 75%.
Wow.
So it's not a huge shift. It's only about 6 percentage points higher. But when you're talking about a group that's about 6% of the electorate in Arizona, that's a big shift and could have made a difference. But of course, by the time Arizona got the results in, the race was all but over.
That's fascinating. Okay, so there was a shift even in Arizona in these very specific ways. And that makes sense, right? Because the Harris campaign, as we've talked about on the show with you before, has made a very concerted effort to reach out to LDS voters in Arizona, specifically women.
That's correct. Yeah, it was interesting to watch how the Harris campaign approached Latter-day Saint voters. Both campaigns eventually got together some sort of Latter-day Saint coalition, meaning that they had folks on the ground that were surrogates of sorts for the campaign and were speaking directly to people in their faith group. But the Harris campaign did it first. And I think that was simply recognition that if Harris wanted to win Arizona and perhaps to a lesser extent Nevada, they would have to put together kind of a unique coalition like Biden did when he won both of those states in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of that are kind of the conservative voters who are disgruntled with the Trump era of the Republican Party. And I think Latter-day Saints in many senses are the poster children for that. I mean, her top surrogates in the state, former Ambassador and Senator Jeff Flake, Mayor John Giles in Mesa, both Latter-day Saint leaders, both individuals who are Republicans, but haven't supported Trump in any of his three elections on top of the ticket. And so that's what we saw. And then, of course, targeting female voters as well. I mean, suburban women carried Biden in 2020 in Arizona. There's no question about that.
Mm-hmm.
And Harris overperformed Biden in that sense, but it was other issues that led to her loss.
Very interesting. Okay, so I wanted to ask you about the Jeff Flakes, the Mitt Romneys, the John Giles, right, of the world. These LDS leaders in politics who have been very outspokenly against Trump, sort of principled traditional conservative. Are there a lot of those left in LDS politics in Utah as well, or is this kind of a dying breed?
That's the question. Mitt Romney retires next month. You know, his term ends in the Senate. And so once he leaves, there will not be a single Latter-day Saint office holder in the U.S. Senate or the House who didn't support Trump in the 2024 election. So once Latter-day Saints were kind of these, you know, this bulwark against perhaps the Trumpward lurch in the Republican Party. But with Romney's exit, we just don't have that anymore. In Utah Governor Spencer Cox, who both in 2016 and 2020 was a fierce Trump critic. Even earlier in this cycle, he was saying he wasn't going to support Trump and he was disappointed in his party for supporting Trump. He eventually came out and endorsed Trump as well.
Wow.
And so there's kind of this dearth of leaders in leadership positions within the Republican Party or office holders, either at a statewide level or a national level, that are Latter-day Saints that are opposing Trump. And even folks like you mentioned, like Ambassador Flake, or Mayor Giles, either aren't in office anymore or won't be at the end of this year.
Very interesting. So tell us about that shift, right, in somebody like the governor of Utah. Like, what are the pro-Trump, or at least the LDS politicians who have endorsed Donald Trump, say to voters who they know very well may be turned off by many of these things you mentioned about him?
Well, Cox is such an interesting case study because he did it in a way that wasn't like many of the other folks who have endorsed Trump. He didn't host like a grandiose press conference or put out a big statement. It was actually somewhat accidental. He sent a letter shortly after the assassination attempt in Pennsylvania last July to Trump, simply saying that, "I want to help you unite the country." He viewed the assassination attempt as this kind of a turning point in the election cycle. He thought Trump had an opportunity to lower the temperature in our divisive politics. And he thought and expected Trump to use it as an opportunity to do so. Now, of course, that isn't what happened. That letter ended up getting leaked. We reported on that. And then Cox later in a news conference, just kind of a routine monthly news conference, announced that he was voting for Trump. But aside from that instance, and then Cox later going to Arlington National Cemetery with Trump and then attending one Trump rally, he really wasn't a present figure on the Trump campaign. But it was kind of a unique situation that I think as we get farther and farther away from this presidential cycle, it'll be worth following up with Cox and understanding what went into that decision and that calculus, and did it pay off?
All right, we'll have to leave it there for now. Samuel Benson, national political correspondent for the Deseret News, joining us. Samuel, thank you so much for coming back on. Appreciate it.
Happy to. Thank you.
Phoenix and the Valley continue to look for ways to reduce the impacts of extreme heat, and the state's biggest city has been experimenting with cool pavement in an effort to do that. Officials say Phoenix has put the coating on more than 100 miles of road since it started its program in 2020. The goal is to reflect heat away from the surface. New research suggests the cool pavement is doing that, but it comes with trade-offs. Jennifer Vanas is an associate professor in the School of Sustainability and the Global Futures Laboratory at ASU. Her research largely focuses on understanding the exposures and impacts of extreme heat on humans. She joins me to talk about this new data. And Jennifer, what to you are the main takeaways from this most recent research?
Yeah, there's so many things that we have been testing and want to continue to test on the Cool Pavement Pilot Program with the City of Phoenix. Some of the newer data we collected that stood out to me was looking at the UV reflectance, and we learned that there is no additional UV, so ultraviolet radiation reflection, from these cool pavement surfaces compared to something like asphalt or concrete. So that was good to see, as it's a concern that many people bring up. We also tested a couple different types of surfaces and found not too large of differences between them in terms of the products that the city of Phoenix is thinking about using in the future. And I think what's promising to us also is that some of the phase one results that we tested from 2020, we were able to find the exact same results, which being able to repeat experiments and find the same data provides more robust results to the city and to other end users.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because it seems as though some of what you found now really corresponds with what you have found in the past.
Yes, yes. And so being able to have that repeated data collected and find very similar results in terms of performance gives us more confidence in what we're finding on the surface, above the surface, and so forth in terms of the potential positive impacts or trade-offs that we might need to understand as we think about applying these kinds of technologies in the real world.
Well, so let's talk about at least one of those trade-offs, which is that the data has been showing now that while the cool pavement does reduce the temperature of the surface, it actually can make things warmer for people who are standing on it. Like if you're walking across a street that has cool pavement on it, it will feel a little bit warmer to you than it would otherwise. So I'm curious how you use that data. Like what does that tell you in terms of maybe the kind of material used or maybe the way in which this cool pavement should be used?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And it's an important consideration when we think about where we apply cool pavement. What it does indicate to us is that in the middle of the day, if a person is standing on this surface, there is a high reflection from the surface. But that indicates to us that the pavement is working how it's supposed to, right? It's supposed to reflect more sunlight back out, but that sunlight is supposed to escape the urban environment and not hit buildings or people. And so this is a necessary trade-off of the way this technology works. Now, what I would say is that we don't want people walking in the middle of roads, and our results show that there's no difference in exposures if someone is walking on a sidewalk next to one of these coated roadways, especially a sidewalk that is shaded. And then second, it tells us where would be optimal or suboptimal locations for putting this. So we really don't want to be putting it in places where there's a lot of foot traffic middle of the day. And that's where we see these differences. So we wouldn't want to be putting this in places like parks or playgrounds or plazas where we expect to have more foot traffic in the middle of the day throughout the year, because it can increase that overall total heat burden on a person, which radiation, especially in the desert, is a large component of that.
I wonder if there's maybe, for lack of a better word, sort of a branding or a PR problem that we have with cool pavement, in the sense that people maybe think that it is capable of doing things that it isn't. And I ask because, you know, you talk about this, and I think for a lot of folks, you think, oh, great, it's going to make everything feel cooler, when, as you've discussed, that's not really what it's meant to do overall.
Yeah, it is really interesting to think about this, and even the perception of what feels cooler to people, because we often just think about air temperature. But what increases our overall heat load the most in a place like Phoenix is that sun, that exposure to the sun. And it really can make us think about what are the most appropriate or effective heat mitigation strategies for a place like Phoenix that does have a lot of sun exposure and high air temperature. And the best way here to reduce our overall heat burden in the summertime is to reduce sun exposure. One of the largest benefits of this technology that needs to be monitored over the long term is just that subsurface temperature reduction and how that may be helping sustain the pavement over a longer period and thus result in less maintenance needs to seal it again, to replace the entire street again over the long term, so that the city is really hopeful that they don't have to do as much of that spending on the update of the streets so often.
So it kind of also serves as a like almost a protective coating for the road underneath.
Yes. And I think that's where we're seeing the greatest benefits. We don't talk about it as much, but we see pretty large decreases, of course, in the surface temperature, but it's in that radiation that the heat is not getting to the subsurfaces either, which is supporting less thermal expansion, which should help lengthen the lifespan of the road.
Is there research or development going on in terms of trying to refine the surface or maybe change it up in some way to try to improve on the results?
Definitely. Actually, from our 2020 phase one results with the city of Phoenix, the company we work with, GuardTop, created what's called a Cool Seal 2.0, or the Phoenix Gray, because of some of the input from the residents, actually, in saying they didn't like how light or white it looked, and you could see so much more like oil and dirt on it. They wanted it to look more like a pavement or concrete. So the company created a Phoenix Gray, which still has the performance in terms of reflection as the initial Cool Seal 1.0, but looks more like your traditional pavement. And so that's really good to see. One of the things I really try to do is use our results from the field to push industry to innovate more and more in this space, because I feel like there's so much more that can be done.
So what then is next in terms of research? Like, what do you want to find out next? What do you feel like maybe you need to find out next?
We really need to see the long-term benefits, if they, and what they are, if they exist, to what extent. So we need to be looking at what is that difference in the long-term surface temperature, subsurface temperature, reflectivity of these surfaces compared to the traditional coatings that are used that are lower cost. And if we can be monitoring those long-term changes over time and start to see the benefits, we can put some economic assessment on that and really be able to say, especially to the taxpayers, like, where is the benefit coming from with these coatings?
Sure. All right. Jennifer, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks, Mark.
Jennifer Vinas is an associate professor in the School of Sustainability and the Global Futures Laboratory at ASU. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a Valley businessman shows us his floor-to-ceiling collection of hundreds of vintage guitars.
But first,
as the dust settles from November's election and the sweeping winds Republicans saw here and around the country, Democrats in control here in Arizona are reacting and figuring out how they might approach the incoming Trump administration. And they're reacting differently. Attorney General Chris Mayes, for example, is talking tough, saying she will continue her prosecution of Arizona's slate of so-called fake electors from the 2020 election. And she says she will oppose Trump on any unconstitutional actions. But Governor Katie Hobbs is taking a different tact. A coalition of Democratic officials from other states are joining together to get ready to fight Trump, but not Hobbs. She said last week, quote, "I don't think that's the most productive way to govern Arizona," and that she'd work with anyone who's doing what's right for our state. And both of our next guests are unhappy with these reactions. Phil Boas is a columnist with the Arizona Republic, and he joins editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning to talk more about it all. Good morning to you both, Phil, Elvia.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. So, Elvia, I want to start with you because you really took the governor to task here in your most recent column about her reaction when she was asked about how she will handle an incoming Trump administration. Tell us why.
Well, you know what? When political parties and candidates and leaders lose this badly in elections, there's always an overcorrection from my point of view of what they did wrong, right? In this case, Governor Hobbs is not only overcorrecting her failures, but she is moving to the right and not even saying exactly why or how. I understand she's heading to the border either today or this week and, you know, being ready to use the National Guard, we don't know in what capacity. And essentially, she's now standing up to Trump. I mean, she should have said, and she should have done like Chris Mayes did, you know, oppose Trump on anything that is unconstitutional at the very least, but she's not. She's essentially caving to Donald Trump and moving to the right. And I think I know why. I think we know why. I mean, she's up for re-election in 2 years, and she thinks that by being Trump's useful tool, that that's going to re-elect her. But she's very wrong on this one.
Yeah, and you really were focusing on your critique of her reaction to immigration under Trump. As you said, she's heading to the border this week. What do you think you would like to see her do? Like, what could a Democratic governor in a border state do to oppose, you know, something like the proposed mass deportations that Trump has said he will carry out?
Well, you know, to begin with, and I say it in my column, no one is going to oppose going after criminals, period, right? In this case, you know, Trump is clearly saying that he's going to go after everyone. And if the governor is going to agree and go after everyone and help him, at the very least, she should have the guts to say it. But as we saw last week, she's not. I mean, she's not articulated anything, only that she's going to work with whomever, right? With Trump, with Republicans. And, you know, keep in mind that she has a Republican-controlled legislature that she has to work with. And she thinks that she can work with them. And they're already making every move to oppose her and overwrite her on most everything if it is possible, right? So she's mistaken to cater to MAGA instead of recruiting more moderates to her camp. She's just not doing it. So we'll see.
All right. So Phil, I want to turn to you and talk about your critique in a recent column as well of Chris Mays, our attorney general. You called it something like a retreat, even as she was acting like a kingmaker. Tell us about this.
Well, in the post-election, Chris Mays basically did what the governors of Illinois, Massachusetts, California, the Democratic governors there did, and that is to join the resistance against Trump. You know, this was something that was started the last time he became president, and it was, you know, standing athwart your state and declaring that you're not going to stand for him shredding the Constitution, which is exactly what Chris Mays did. And said the problem for her is she's not the governor of Arizona. And she has her own podium and she can say what she wants. But in the same little press scrum, she also said that she was raising the white flag on her supposed criminal investigation of Donald Trump for remarks he made at a rally in Glendale just before the end of the election, which Democrats accused him of making a death threat against Liz Cheney. And that's preposterous.
So I want to talk about both of these approaches, right? These two very different approaches to this incoming administration. People have some sense of what might happen. This is the second time Trump will be in office. But I wonder politically, like, what might play better, you think, in Arizona, right? Like, we have seen a lot of Democrats and Republicans, for that matter, win here by kind of playing the middle. Phil, start there if you can.
Here's what's happening. I mean, Katie Hobbs is making her accommodation with reality. Arizona just voted for Trump by 6 points. The Republican legislature grew stronger. Latinos are increasingly more and more voting for Trump. Illegal immigration is a key concern in this state. And Katie Hobbs is sort of plying the middle, looking at an election 2 years from now when she has to win a general election. And so she kept her distance from Kamala Harris. That now looks prudent. You know, and you have the opposite coming from Mays. Mays is ready to go to war, which would help her in a Democratic primary, but would also make her toast in a general election.
So, yeah, let me throw that question to you then, Elvia. Like, you specifically talked about what Hobbs did and not showing up basically for Kamala Harris in your column. Do you think that that was a betrayal of a sort, it sounds like?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what, listening to Phil and remembering what I said, it kind of reinforces everything that is wrong with politics today and the overcorrection that I was saying at the beginning. I mean, we're talking about the political leader's future and not what is best for Arizona. Well, we're talking about what Hobbs needs to do to get elected, what Mays needs to do to get elected and possibly win the governorship instead of talking about what is best for the country, what is best for everyone. And when Phil and others talk about the resistance As if it is something dirty, something wrong, something like, oh my gosh, you know, Trump was elected with a great majority. Is reality? Well, if reality is so awful for so many people, why would I or anyone say, oh, well, we have to deal with this reality. Oh, well, I mean, there are going to be abuses. You know, that's what people want. No, the resistance means, and for many people, is not having a choice, right? Because they are going to get hurt.
Phil, let me ask you about that, because what she's saying reminds me of what the larger critique has been of the Democratic loss here and the party's approach to this election in general, which was that they were not speaking to the reality of the American people. And lots of critics and politicos kind of saying that they were missing the mark there. They were not acknowledging that people were unhappy with the economy and immigration and things like that. Do you agree with that approach, even if you might disagree with her on how to talk about it?
You know, I think that after you have a shocking defeat like the Democrats have had, your first impulse is to want to place blame. And so we're going through that right now. I mean, that's what's happening within the Democratic Party. But if I were advising the Democratic Party, I would advise them to start being liberals again. You know, start defending free speech again. You used to be the lions of free speech. Why don't you do that again instead of looking for ways you can regulate speech and control people? Look at what's going on with all these Democrats who are very openly talking about how they're leaving Twitter for Blue Sky. They can't even stand to associate with the right, you know, with the broader swath of people that voted for President Trump. That's not going to win you elections in the future.
It sounds like you might agree there, Alvia.
Yes and no. I mean, we have to talk about what real people on the ground are feeling, right? And I could care less about the political parties and the leaders, right? I mean, maybe what the Democrats need is to begin from the beginning, right? Find new people, find fresh blood, right? And start there and connect with real folks. But again, if someone is telling me that I need to disappear, why would I listen to that person, right? I mean, if someone is telling me that I'm not welcome here, why should I listen to this person? If Trump is going to do what he says he's going to do, and he is making every move to do it, why should we if we know it's bad for the country?
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Editorial page editor for the Arizona Republic, Alvia Diaz, joined by columnist Philip Boas this morning. Thank you both for coming on. Thanks for parsing this. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A pair of global summits this week are drawing attention to environmental and economic issues worldwide. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Pete Ross in London. And Pete, let's start in Azerbaijan, where the UN's annual climate conference, COP29, will wrap up on Friday. What has been the story so far, and what can we expect this week?
Yeah, it's been a fairly rocky road for this year's United Nations Climate Conference, which, as you say, is taking place in Azerbaijan. Even before the conference began, it hit some rocky ground. Days before it was due to open last Monday, here at the BBC, we reported that a senior Azerbaijani official appeared to have used his role at COP to arrange a meeting to discuss potential fossil fuel deals. That was followed up a couple of days later by the president of Azerbaijan telling world leaders gathering at the summit that natural gas was, quote, a gift from God, and he shouldn't be blamed for trying to bring it to the market. Now, many say that then prompted a letter that came out at the end of last week, written by a number of key experts, including a former UN Secretary General and a former UN climate chief, who described the COP talks as, quote, no longer fit for purpose and in need of an urgent overhaul. So they're not going great, I guess, is what you would say. Just a little reminder about the sort of history of these COP talks. It is fair to say that in the past they have made significant progress, particularly in recent years, on reaching an agreement at the end of each summit. Probably the biggest agreement or the most well-known agreement is the one signed in Paris in 2015. And that outlines a long-term plan by nations to try and limit the rising global temperatures to less than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. That's the one that you will have heard of many times. However, this year, given some of the reasons that I've already explained, it's not looking that likely, or it's not looking that optimistic that an agreement can be reached. Just final thing to say on this, the agreement they're hoping to reach this time is a financial one. And it was hoped before this summit began that a consensus could be found on a financial package for developing countries at the sharp end of the planet's changing climate. Whether that agreement will be reached, it's not looking very likely just now, but we've got 4 or 5 more days of summit. So who knows?
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see on that. All right. So, Pete, from the COP29 summit in Azerbaijan to another significant global summit, this one, the G20, that begins today in Brazil. Leaders from the world's 20 largest economies will be in Rio to discuss a host of issues, including the environment and proposals for a so-called billionaire tax. So what can you tell us about this one?
Yeah, again, as you said, another big summit taking place. Leaders from the world's 20 largest economies gathering in Brazil to discuss, you know, and let's be honest, there are plenty of problems in the world right now for those leaders to discuss. But here's one thing, and you mentioned it as you were introducing me there, Mark, this idea of a so-called billionaire tax. It's being touted by the president of Brazil, who are hosting this year's G20, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, says he wants to try and progress plans to tax the world's richest billionaires, who often, it's argued, use complex loopholes to avoid paying tax. So the plan goes like this. It was devised by a French economist called Gabriel Zucman, and what he wants to introduce is an annual tax of 2% on the total net worth of extremely wealthy individuals. So that's wealth, not their annual income. So taxing things like, you know, the properties that they own, corporate shareholdings, other investments, things like that. Now, listen to these figures for just a second. Zucman reckons, you know, it's his reckoning, but he estimates that the top 0.01% of the population, that would be figured out to be almost 3,000 billionaires globally, if they paid an effective tax rate of just 0.3% of their collective wealth, Zucman reckons that would raise $250 billion annually that could be spent, you know, to help to tackle some of the globe's growing inequalities. Now, if you think $250 billion is a big amount of money, and that perhaps, you know, that's too much to ask of these billionaires, well, just consider this other figure. Zucman, the economist, reckons that $250 billion would come from an estimated worth of these 3,000 individuals of some $13.5 trillion. And I'm sorry, Mark, but when we start to get into trillions, I just cannot wrap my head around that figure. An awful lot of money. But look out for that. I think a lot of people will be interested to hear about a proposed billionaires tax, particularly with the cost of living crisis being felt in many countries around the world.
Yeah, that is interesting. All right, Pete. So finally this week, following President Biden's announcement that he has given Ukraine permission to use long-range missiles supplied by Washington to strike deep inside Russia for the first time, what has the reaction been so far, and what can we expect on that this week?
Yeah, I'm sure you and your listeners know, Mark, that this is something that Ukraine's President Zelensky has been pushing for months, the ability to strike Russia deep within its own territory. And it's now thought that Ukraine's use of the ATACMS, the Army Tactical Missile System, will now mean that, you know, that they can now do exactly that. And they argue that that will allow them to better defend themselves. Now, it comes at a time when Russian forces are creeping forward all along the Eastern Front, and they have been for months. And the announcement also comes as a major Russian counteroffensive is expected in the Kursk region. You remember, that's the small part of Russia that where Ukraine launched its surprise offensive earlier this year, and it still holds some of that land there. Now, that that counteroffensive by Russia is going to be assisted by as many as 10,000 troops from North Korea. And it's the presence of those troops, foreign troops fighting on behalf of Russia, that many military analysts reckon prompted Biden to make this announcement. That and perhaps the fact that he only has 2 months left in office before Donald Trump arrives to take over. Now, you've asked about reaction. Well, it has sparked a furious reaction in Russia. That's not unexpected. The Russian government newspaper, the Royska Gazeta, said on Monday morning, departing US President Joe Biden has taken one of the most provocative, uncalculated decisions of his administration, which risks catastrophic consequences. That's a sentiment that's been echoed by other government news agencies and pro-Kremlin voices. Someone that we haven't heard from so far at the time of recording, Russia's president himself, Vladimir Putin. So wait to hear on that. However, this is not the first time that the West has been told if it does X, then that would prompt Y, an escalation from Russia. So let's see. I mean, they said that if this was to happen, that they will respond. As of yet, there's been angry words, but no other response apart from that.
Interesting. All right. That is the BBC's Pete Ross in London. Pete, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Always great to talk to you, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Most people have heard the phrase social butterfly. If you're describing someone that way, more often than not, you're talking about someone who's somewhat status-minded, maybe looking to raise their profile. But it turns out that social insects are an actual biological phenomenon. And the definition is nothing like what we imagine when we hear the phrase social butterfly. For one thing, they usually aren't butterflies. According to Professor Anna Dornhaus at the University of Arizona, the most social insects are actually termites, wasps, bees, and ants. But more importantly, true social insects are never looking to raise their own profile. In fact, Dornhaus says they're genetically engineered against self-preservation. Their entire focus is on the preservation of the colony. Dornhaus runs an entire lab that studies this phenomenon. This past spring, she spoke with the show's Sam Dingman about the behaviors of these social insects and what human beings can learn from them.
I wanted to ask you about a fascinating quote of yours I read in Arizona Highways, where you said, my broad argument is that ants and other social insects have collective strategies that have been optimized over millions of years. Collective strategies are not necessarily intuitive for humans.
So humans struggle with collective action problems all the time, right? So in human societies, precisely because we are evolved the quote-unquote normal way, the way that our brain is constructed, we are thinking of our individual benefit. For example, if you're thinking of a potluck, right, we all benefit if everybody brings a delicious dish to the potluck. And it's not a lot of work to make one dish, and then you get this amazing buffet. But one person might think, well, everybody else is bringing these amazing dishes, I'll just bring a bag of chips. That'll be much cheaper.
Right.
I've still got an amazing buffet. And,
I think I've been the bag of chips person, so I'm cringing.
Okay, but the problem with the bag of chips, if there's one bag of chips person, it's not really a problem.
Right.
But then the other people see that and they're like, oh, that person just brought a bag of chips and I made, a roast chicken.
Yeah.
But I could also, next time I'll just bring a bag of chips. And that can lead to a kind of collapse of the whole thing.
Yeah. It makes me think of the whole not in my backyard debate, where you might have somebody who is, broadly speaking, in favor of a shelter for unhoused people, but they don't want that shelter to be built near their house.
Exactly. We always need kind of an external structure, for example, taxation or imposed order, to prevent these collective action problems from leading to a deterioration of the conditions for everybody.
Wow.
That's one way in which the ants have sort of a lead on us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
are ahead of the game. But there's another way that actually has nothing to do with cooperation or not cooperation. And that's what I was thinking of more in that quote.
Mm-hmm.
So when the ants are actually doing something, so for example, they want to collect food, and in order to collect food, they have to search for the food. and there's a very large area that they have to search in. The ants have evolved strategies for solving those problems.
Would this be the study I think I read about meandering?
Yes, what we are saying is they're sort of starting with a random walk, but then on the random walk, instead of just going in a random direction straight, they're doing this kind of left to right meander. So, you know, as if you were regularly going a little bit left and then a little bit right and then forward and a little bit left again. So like a meandering river.
And then what would happen if one of these meandering ants was to discover food?
So when ants discover something interesting, food or a new nest site or an enemy or whatever, they usually go straight back to the nest and tell the others about it.
Huh.
And so this is another thing that we're interested in studying is what information do they actually share?
Is that the dilemma that is behind one of the other very interesting quotes that I found on your website, which was, biological systems are often more noisy than engineered ones. However, they typically surpass artificial systems in their robustness to a wide variety of adversities.
Yeah, absolutely. So individual ants for sure make mistakes. You know, they recruit to the wrong thing or they forget where they were. Mm-hmm. And we don't necessarily know in detail why these failures happen. But if ants were just walking around randomly, that would be robust, but not very efficient. If the ants were always doing these systematic searches, that would be efficient, but it wouldn't be very robust. It would quickly become inefficient if you make any kind of errors.
Yeah.
And so we think that the meandering is just such a strategy that compromises between robustness and efficiency and therefore achieves both.
This is an odd association, but have you ever seen the movie Alien?
Yeah, with Sigourney Weaver.
Yes. Am I
a long time ago?
I just had this thought as you were describing that movie is sort of about the degree to which the human brain rejects this ant or social insect type of thinking. Because if you think about it, that movie is about this group of people who have been sent out into space to recover some compound and bring it back. They don't really know what the compound is or why they've been sent to retrieve it. And then on their way back, they get this message from a disembodied entity that they refer to, I think, as Mother, that has given them an order that says, nope, you've been redirected. You have to go over to this other planet and bring back this species that actually wants to kill all of you. But it's more important to our interests as a broader colony to understand this thing than it is for you guys to survive. And they rebel against that and they kill the thing that they're supposed to bring back for greater understanding. And if I'm understanding correctly, if we imagine a version of the movie Alien where all the characters are ants, they would have very willingly brought this thing back, even if it was going to kill all of them, because they would have had just this basic understanding that, like, it's better for the colony in the long term for this thing to come back. Mm-hmm. Ours is not to wonder why.
That's right. And we don't really know if they wonder why or not, or if they know why. But yeah, in the literal sense, value the success of the colony over their own life or their own success. Humans often get a little depressed when I say they're not as altruistic as ants or bees are. But I actually think that's the wrong way to think about it. I think we are, in fact, from a biologist's point of view, already incredibly altruistic, surprisingly close to social insects compared to chimpanzees, for example, or many other animals. Even those that do live in groups, humans are quite willing even to sacrifice life and limb, but certainly to invest in small and large ways in the communal good.
Right.
And so anthropologists debate why this is the case. Many biologists argue it has to do with the fact that we evolved in small groups of probably mostly related individuals. So in some ways, our brain is probably constructed to expect that most of the people immediately around us are our relatives, which we have some even biological interest in helping. Whatever the reason is, humans are actually quite willing to even pay fairly high costs to ensure the success of the group as a whole.
Right. And that
potluck story notwithstanding.
Right. for all the bag of chips guys out there, there's more roast chicken people.
yes, there are a surprising number of roast chicken people. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the concept of potlucks, right?
Right.
Otherwise, we would just say, bring a roast chicken or stay home.
Well, Professor Anna Dornhaus, this has been a fascinating conversation. I'm never going to look at an anthill the same way ever again.
Okay, wonderful.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Joe Domt has loved guitar ever since he started playing when he was 10. A few years later, after buying and selling a guitar for the first time, Domt realized something. He could play as many rare vintage guitars as he wanted if he bought and sold them. With a business degree and a love for old instruments, Domt founded Joe's Vintage Guitars. Now he earns a living shopping for, refurbishing, and selling guitars. He wouldn't give away too much about how he finds guitars, but he's traveled as far as Kentucky and West Virginia to pick up gear and instruments. He's built up quite the collection. Domt runs his business out of a small warehouse in Mesa. The one-story gray building on Stapley in Maine doesn't have any signs indicating what's on the inside. That's by design. You can only look at Domt's vintage guitars online or by appointment. The main workspace holds a few hundred guitars. The walls are lined with shelves holding rows of guitars and glass cases with guitar pedals and other gear. Most of the floor space is taken up by a maze of amps and guitar cases stacked on top of each other. The show's Amber Victoria Singer met up with Domt in a cozy corner of his warehouse, where he showed off a few of his favorite pieces.
My name is Joe Domt. I'm 29 years old, and I'm a vintage guitar dealer. I probably have in the neighborhood of 500 to 700 right now. I started selling guitars when I was, the first one was probably when I was 14, when I purchased an instrument for myself and then sold it on the open market and kind of realized there was a potential there to make some profit. And from then on out, I used it as an opportunity to try all kinds of gear out, things that I enjoyed, acquire guitars that I wouldn't have been able to otherwise. 698 guitars at once was the most we ever bought. And we've done 300, 100, 40, and sometimes I'll drive across the country for one guitar, if it's the right guitar. The farthest I've ever gone was to Maine. I think the most expensive single guitar I've ever sold, it was a 1954 Strat in factory blonde finish that I got $69,000 for. So this guitar is really cool. This is a 1971 Fender Mustang, and the finish is called Competition Blue. The competition is actually talking about a little racing stripe on the corner. The cool thing about this guitar is that it was made in 1971. And if you look at the sticker right here inside the case, it says Milano Music Center, Mesa, Arizona. So this was bought new in 1971 at Milano Music, which is like 2 miles down the street. These were marketed towards kids at the time, actually. So this would have been like a Christmas present for someone or like a starter guitar. But they've kind of obtained a following because they are actually quite well made and really cool looking guitars. So this one is a 1959 Gibson case. It's got the brown leather exterior and it's got the pink interior. It's funny you ask about the case. This is actually my favorite type of case. I just think that brown and pink looks so good. And it's very iconically Gibson because for the 50s, to have a bright neon pink interior for a case was a little out of left field. As for the guitar in the case, this is a 1959 Gibson ES-355. ES stands for electric Spanish guitar, because back then steel guitars were popular with the slide, so you had to differentiate, and the steel guitar was called a electric or a steel guitar, and you had to say Spanish guitar when it had frets. The number initially, this changed over time, but initially the number was how much it cost. So in theory, an ES-355 would have cost $355 back in the day. Okay, this guitar is a 1966 Fender Stratocaster. It's a standard sunburst finish. This guitar, in really nice condition, is probably worth about $15,000. Just has a great sound. It's super well worn in. You can tell it's been played a lot. And there's kind of an old adage in the guitar world that the good ones got played a lot. So if you see a super worn-in one, it's probably a good sounding and playing guitar. So this is a lap steel guitar, kind of known for that Hawaiian sound, or if you've ever seen SpongeBob, you'll hear a lot of this in SpongeBob. They don't sell that well because not that many people like them or play them, but I kind of have a little bit of a illogical obsession with them. But this is actually a Rickenbacker, really early 1930s Rickenbacker, but it's rebranded Mary Steven, probably for sale at some department store that wanted to rename it or whatever. But this has a all Bakelite body. It's all one piece of molded Bakelite, and it's got that very cool. Normally they would color these, make them black or whatever, but the cool thing about this one is they kind of just kept that natural Bakelite brown. Do you want me to play it or no?
Sure.
Is that, okay,
yeah.
Cool.
I don't want to say no to that.
All right, I'll play it a little bit.
That was Joe Dompt of Joe's Vintage Guitars.
All right, and that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Be sure to join us tomorrow morning with much more as always. And don't forget, you can follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.